Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam and I are talking with Assistant Professor in the Department of Family Medicine, Dr. Kelly Bossenbrook, about controversies in chronic pain. There are many controversies in taking care of people who have pain, and I think this will be a good conversation, Adam.
It is, because so many people are suffering from chronic pain, and so many providers are sometimes at a loss on how best to negotiate treatment. Mm-hmm. So we'll hopefully begin that conversation today. But first, Christy, we have some conversations about some research that matters, including research about hepatitis C.
And about fructose.
Sugar.
Yes, and about primary care and its relationship to mortality or death.
Having physicians like us matter.
Yeah, I love this study.
And finally, about dietary fiber and diabetes. I like this research, Chris. Let's dive right in about hepatitis C, research that was in the Annals of Internal Medicine.
Okay, so this isn't quite as uplifting as the rest, but the story here is that hepatitis C, which is the kind of hepatitis that is chronic most of the time, so it stays with you. There are estimated 3.2 million Americans who have this infection, and half of them don't even know it. And eventually, can kill your liver and be a very serious infection.
And I guess one of the things that struck me about this particular research, Christy, was the fact that hepatitis C now kills more people in the United States each year than HIV disease. There are over 15,000 Americans that died last year from, in the previous year, they had the statistics from hepatitis C. And I thought, wow, as a provider, I knew hepatitis C was important, but that really struck me. And I thought, because there are some medications now to treat it that we didn't have a decade ago, so we should try to figure this out a little better.
Well, and our thinking about it should be different now that there are treatments for it. We screen people for HIV because of a variety of factors and because we do have some treatment medications for it. But this is one that we've been perhaps missing. And the people who are at the highest risk and who the recommendation is that we consider screening are the people in that baby boomer category. People born between 1945 and 1964 are the folks who are, that's you, Adam.
My hand went
have
up.
You been screened
my
for
hand
hepatitis
went
C?
Up. Well, I've given blood before, and that's actually one of the good news is that if you actually give blood, your blood gets screened for hepatitis C here. So even though I'm not in a high-risk group and I've not had IV drug abuse or received blood transfusions myself, there is some question maybe everyone should get screened for this. And perhaps if everyone gave blood, everyone would get screened.
That's a good point, to be helping people and screening yourself.
Because I had a patient who actually gave blood, Christy, a couple months ago and then came in to see me and said he has tests said that he was positive for hepatitis C. And we couldn't come up with his risk factor in the past, but I did get him into see a hepatitis C specialist, and they're talking about treatment.
Well, one thing I want to just clarify about blood donations is that since 1992, all blood donations in the United States have been tested for hepatitis C. But if you received a transfusion before that time, or if you did, casual injection, drug use, or other things that could put you at risk, then getting screened for hepatitis C is super important.
Okay. Let's talk about our next. From the real serious to perhaps something that appears more simple but affects probably everyone, which is fructose in their diet. And what do we know about research about weight gain with the fructose?
Okay, so there's all this concern about high fructose corn syrup. It's a main ingredient in our foods and our drinks. It's in soda. And in this particular research, they were looking at people who consumed the extra fructose baked into breads or sprinkled into their drinks and whether or not they gained extra weight compared to those who didn't do that.
In this study in the Annals of Internal Medicine, looking at multiple studies, over 30 studies that included over 600 people, and the types of diets that they had and where they got their fructose in their diet, and did it lead to increased weight gain?
So the bottom line is that if you add extra simple sugar in your diet by sprinkling it on your drinks or on your food, it's probably not going to make you gain weight as long as you cut down on other carbs and calories to make up for it. So that the fructose itself didn't lead to gaining more weight as much as just your total calories in the day.
Yeah, you know, it's the calories, stupid.
Right. I mean, I read this and was like, well, duh. I mean,
you know, so it's, you know, if you want to put that teaspoon of sugar in the cup of coffee, or 3 teaspoons in sugar, as someone very near and dear to me that lives with me does, it's probably okay. But you pay the piper. You're going to have to cut back on calories somewhere else.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think those sugar drinks and putting sugar into your tea and that sort of thing, that's an easy place to cut down on calories. And that's, most of us need to cut down on calories in America. So I do not recommend that people do this, not because the fructose is particularly bad, but because it's more calories that go to our growing bottoms.
And I could have commented on that one, Christy, but I will say, if you want to put that sugar in there and drink your cup of coffee and make it sweet, just take 2 or 3 bites less of whatever it is you're eating.
Don't have dessert. Okay.
Let's listen to our very next research that matters. Something that's really critical. Christy and I talk about primary care and family medicine, and you know we're great big champions, but maybe one of the questions is, does it really help?
So we've got like population data. If you look at a map and look at all the dots of where primary care doctors are, there is a strong relationship of areas where there are not as many of those dots of primary care doctors have worse health outcomes. But this was a study looking at the patient level. So if we're looking from the patient perspective, their reported access to primary care and different attributes of that to see if that's associated with death, their risk of dying.
And so this research in the Annals of Internal Medicine looked at over 50,000 patients, and they came up with what is called a National Death Index. It does not sound light. It's not light, but really important, looking at things like the how people dying relates to their ability to have comprehensive care, patient-centered care, or what's called enhanced care, this team-based care. What do we know?
And what we found were that the people who had the least access to comprehensive primary care, patient-centered primary care, and access or enhanced access like nighttime and easy access into a clinic, if the patients who were least likely to have that were most likely to die over a 5-year period or 5 or 6 year period that they followed this, which is pretty striking to me.
And it was actually a linear association, meaning for every point increase that you had, the more protective, or for the less access one had, maybe a lower score, the worse death you had, which suggests that it does matter if you have a primary care provider.
And a home.
And a home that cares about you.
Absolutely. Well, we can continue on this conversation. I'm sure we could talk about it for hours, but it makes me feel important.
Well, and it makes me tell, I was just in Atlanta this past weekend, Christy, and I was talking with some friends who I had not seen in 25 years, and they heard I was a family doctor, and their question was, well, what's a family doctor? And what does one do? Because they're in an inner city. Mm-hmm. And I was describing to them, and they were like, well, why doesn't everyone have, you know, a family doctor or a pediatrician or a general internist, depending on their ages? And we had this long conversation. And so I do think there's a lot of education about that this research helps address.
Yeah. And I would say if you're listening out there and you don't have a usual doctor in a relationship with a primary care doctor, it's a good idea to get one.
Let's talk about our very last research that matters, research in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine about fiber and diabetes.
Okay, so bottom line is there is some relationship that fiber intake and control of diabetes could be related, but the evidence about that is mixed. So they looked at studies, 15 different studies, to see
one of these systematic review meta-analyses, putting them all together, and they did find that there was people who had fiber who did not had better fasting blood sugars and had lower hemoglobin A1Cs, that 3-month average blood sugar control. I was impressed.
I was impressed because there's not a lot of downside to taking dietary fiber. There can be some GI kind of, you know, people might get more gas or something like that, but it's pretty safe to recommend.
A little gassier, a little gassier.
Yeah, well, yeah. But the A1C difference was 0.26%. So it is a significant difference, but it's not like to replace taking a medication if you're on one. Or I mean, really the answer is usually in weight loss.
No, but I bet this becomes a standard of care now for diabetes. Mm-hmm. And it should be so that if you are diabetic or know someone and you come into the doctor, they should start talking with you about fiber. Well, cool. That concludes Research That Matters, Christy. We've had a nice chance to not talk about not just about fiber, but about some of the data that backs the value for in terms of longer life of primary care.
Talking about fructose and thinking about your total calories and about hepatitis C and really recommending that folks talk to their doctor about whether or not you should be screened for hepatitis C.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll talk with Dr. Kelly Bossenbrock about controversies in chronic pain. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking about controversies in chronic pain with Dr. Kelly Bossenbrock, assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine at UNC.
And Dr. Bossenbrock, we are glad to have you with us today and glad to have someone who is passionate about a really difficult topic, chronic pain. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, let's dive right in here, which is to say chronic pain is one of the more frequent conditions that we see in our entire practice. I assume this is one of the more frequent conditions in family medicine or primary care. Is that the case?
That is the case. One of the reasons why I became interested in chronic pain was just that I found myself seeing so many patients with that complaint. And some of them had their pain well controlled, some of it wasn't so well controlled, and felt that I really wanted to learn more about it so that I could take better care of my patients.
So, you know, thinking about doctors who go into the business to help people, and people who are hurting and looking for help, what's the controversy? Help us understand sort of some of the pictures of why it gets so difficult.
One of the issues, I think, is that chronic pain and pain itself is such a subjective issue. So we just, you know, patients say that they have pain. We try to rate it. We try to give it a number. We try to qualify it and describe it. But it's not an easy number to come across, such as blood pressure. So I think it's difficult for providers, whether they're physicians or nurse practitioners, to really try to get a handle of the understanding of the patient's pain because it is so subjective.
We can't measure it in a blood test.
Right. It's difficult to measure. And then, in addition to that, there are not great treatments for chronic pain. So we have to balance continuously the benefits and the risks of all these different treatments. And I think that's where we get into a lot of controversy.
Well, can I start with just a question? And I didn't really think about it till we just started this conversation today, which is just the terminology we use. And it's one that I use all the time. Patients come in with complaints. And that terminology itself, when we talk about something like chronic pain, implies perhaps something negative, at least to the provider, and maybe even to the patient. They probably don't think what they're coming in with is a complaint. They're coming in with a feeling that's impacting a quality of life. So maybe we start with the terms that we're using and maybe some controversies around those terms. Well, I use that same term, but why do I use that?
Right. I think that's a great point. I think patients might be coming with concerns, and maybe that's a better way of framing it, that it's a concern, it's impacting their quality of life. It's not necessarily that they are complaining.
Their chief complaint, of what we use in medicine, why the patient came in.
Right, but we do. I mean, we use that vocabulary all the time.
And thinking about a patient's perspective, they're coming to the doctor to say, I have this problem, this pain that's been ongoing, but it's out of control. I can't work. I can't, you know, get dressed because I can't move my back or whatever it is. And we're trying to tease out then how to help them in a way that improves their ability to do those things. So again, like with the language and with maybe the perception or frustration that doctors have to not have great treatments, what have you learned about sort of how to boil that down to the what is the issue and how do we help them?
So I think that you bring up a good point. One of the most important things about chronic pain and the treatment of it is the relationship between the patient and their provider and the education that needs to happen. It is, for most patients, it is not possible to completely relieve their pain, but we do need to set up that expectation in the beginning. So when you first are talking to the patients or the patients are talking to their provider, it's about educating about what can they expect, what results can they expect from these different treatment options, and not that they have the expectation that this is going to go from a 10 to a 0 in terms of their pain levels.
So getting that initial expectation of what can be done and what can't be done, what about the time element in there? How quickly can we go from a pain of 10 to get you to a pain of 5? What should be a reasonable expectation of that? Is that something that we as providers should really be looking to make happen in a day? Or is a week reasonable? How do we negotiate that?
Well, I think there's two pieces. One is the amount of pain that the patient is having, and the other is their function. So ideally, when we see patients, we'd want to measure both of those things. So ask them the estimation of their pain and those levels, but also their function, which arguably is even more important than their level of pain. So when we do these treatments, we hope to see an improvement in the pain numbers, so a decrease in their pain, but also an improvement in function. And that takes several months. So if the person has already had chronic pain, meaning they've had pain for over 3 months, they've been dealing with this for a significant amount of time, it's going to take most likely several different medication trials, dose changes, trials of physical therapy, et cetera, over months to really try to see improvement.
And, you know, I think the expectations that you mentioned are such an important part about framing that relationship, that I think sometimes patients come frustrated because they've been to other doctors and maybe different treatments didn't meet the expectations. And then, you know, having to work out some of that, that, okay, this has been going on for a long time. Let's work together over time to try these options. Do we know anything about improvement of pain or improvement of function with sticking with one doctor versus kind of bouncing around?
There's some evidence that your relationship is important. So whether that's a relationship, it doesn't necessarily have to be with a primary care physician, but some consistency and trying out the plan. So giving it a good shot. I think there's some evidence that can be of benefit for patients. But that said, if you don't necessarily have that good relationship, I think it is prudent for a patient to say, let me look for some other options.
So when someone comes in, like I had a patient just the other day that came in with acute pain, severe low back pain. They had been seen, this isn't chronic pain, but they had been seen at an emergency room a couple times. And the question is, when is it okay to give opiate medication, to give painkillers? Because I think that's right at the crux of this. No one's arguing about can someone take ibuprofen? Should they get physical therapy? Should they try some alternative things? You know what, everyone, it's really should and when is it appropriate to give painkillers? That's the question, unwritten, that seems to be at the forefront of a lot of people's concerns.
That's the controversy and tension.
How do you approach that right at the crux question?
So I think for for acute pain, we commonly prescribe opioid medications. They work well, especially in the acute sense. And when they're used for a short period of time, they don't have a tremendous number of side effects, and it's a little bit more, it's a little bit less controversial. I think where it's much more controversial is where you start thinking about patients who are on higher doses of those types of medications for a long period of time, months, even years. Then it becomes much more controversial whether these medications actually help the patient or are they doing more harm. And then, of course, all the legal implications of those medicines.
So let's talk about, so helping, there are questions about whether or not it helps long term. But in terms of harm, what are the risks to people being on these medications, or how do you weigh that out with the benefit?
So one of the risks in terms of treatment is that it can actually, there are some evidence that your pain actually worsens, that they these medicines make you more sensitive to pain, so they kind of heighten your pain sensitivity. And then there are side effects such as gastrointestinal side effects like constipation that can be very bothersome, can mess up your sleep cycle, so patients have trouble sleeping. And then dependence and addiction and misuse of those medicines, which is, I think, primarily what physicians and providers are mostly concerned about.
So we're going to need to take a short break. When we come back, I want to pick up on this topic then. What are the things that you recommend to help us ensure safe practices for the use of opiates in chronic pain for both providers and for patients because of negotiating that bridge that you were talking about? We'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Kelly Bossenbrook, about chronic pain. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And Adam and I have been talking with Dr. Kelly Bossenbrook, assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine at UNC, about controversies in chronic pain. And Dr. Bossenbrook, before the break, we were talking about using opioid medicines or narcotic medicines for chronic pain and some of the dangers that exist with that. And we wanted to follow up and find out a little from your experience and research of what do you recommend for safe practices for doctors and their patients who decide to go down that route?
So it's definitely an important thing to consider. I think many physicians clearly want to treat patients with chronic pain. They want to help patients improve their function, improve their quality of life. And yet they're nervous because these medications have side effects. They are frequently misused, sometimes abused. So they are hesitant to prescribe. However, I think with a few important things within your practice, you can be more confident in prescribing them. One of the things is having treatment agreements. Some people call them pain contracts. But a treatment agreement is basically discussion with the patient, making sure that everyone's on the same page with what the expectations are of the patient, what the expectations are of the physician. As we talked about before, expectations for pain relief and improvement in function. Sometimes included with that, urine drug screens. It's recommended that patients get those at least once a year. That's to make sure that the medication they are supposed to be taking is actually in their urine and then there are not other illegal substances present.
So if the medicine's not in their urine, you have some concern or at least raise the question, well, where's that medicine going? And if they have other substances in the urine that you didn't prescribe, there could be a substance abuse problem. So diversion and substance abuse would be two reasons why you may not give chronic pain?
Right. So then you would be concerned as a physician that this patient, let's say they don't have their hydrocodone or their Vicodin in their urine, but they do have cocaine. So I'm concerned that they're selling the Vicodin I'm giving them and they're buying cocaine. Clearly, once I have that concern, I should no longer legally be prescribing these types of medicines to that patient.
Well, and that's, with, That's, I'm sorry, I interrupted
sorry.
You. Finish your thought.
Without some type of referral or support for that patient for addiction resources and a therapist, et cetera.
And you mentioned earlier, you touched on the legal implications to the doctor. And that is, you know, if we continue to prescribe a medication to someone who doesn't have it in their urine, then we could have our licenses taken away, right?
That is correct. So one of the jobs of the medical board is to make sure that physicians are appropriately prescribing these medications. I don't think physicians have to be horribly frightened by this. As long as you are being reasonable in your practice, you're following these guidelines, discussing with patients, making sure that you have these drug screens, You don't have to be worried about getting your license taken away as long as you're following some of these basic guidelines.
And what about patients or physicians exploring patient records with the North Carolina database for felonies or people? There's a database we can look at to see who's been in trouble for selling these medicines. Is that part of the protocol?
Correct. So in a first visit, when you're first, as a provider, first trying to figure out if this is a good treatment option for the patient, one of the things you want to do is a risk assessment. There are a couple different risk tools you can use. There's an opioid risk tool that you can use to try to assess, is this person at risk for misusing these medicines in some way? Another thing that you should do is check the North Carolina's controlled substance reporting system. That's online, and providers, physicians can check that. You can see patients' medication histories, make sure they haven't been going to multiple different emergency rooms, things like that. And then also the Department of Corrections, that's what you were referring to, a website to look for felonies where patients have been convicted, not necessarily just that they've been charged, but that they've been convicted of a felony.
You know, one of the things in the recent Whitney Houston debacle, the tragedy, was this discussion on CNN and news networks that, you know, she was getting multiple prescriptions from multiple providers, and it was just really difficult to run this down, to check this down, to see that she was doing it so the provider wouldn't know. And I just found that a little disingenuous because of the information you've just given. And also, when I've called pharmacies in the past to ask, is this patient getting multiple prescriptions? Can we today, is it a standard of care to say that when a patient comes in, that a doctor really should be able to find out pretty quickly and easily if they're getting them from multiple providers?
It depends on the state. Because North Carolina has a great controlled substance data reporting system, but not all states have that. So yes, for me, it's standard of care. We should be doing this in North Carolina. It's very easy at our fingertips, but not for every state.
So we really need to be pushing for some policy advocacy to have other states adopting this, because that might really be an advance.
Correct. And that touches on one of the biggest risks for these medications, which is overdose death. Unfortunately, it's quite frequent.
And that's something, you know, as we're weighing out the potential benefits, which, you know, are small in a lot of the bigger trials, and the potential risks of misuse and death, that's really significant. The other question or controversy I wanted to ask you is about trust. So you talk about the importance of a relationship with one provider, trying things over time, but then we turn around and say, well, we're going to screen your urine, we're going to look you up on the database, you know, and for a patient who's just coming in looking for help, I can imagine that's pretty off-putting or makes you wonder. What do we know about how to overcome that and build trust with patients?
I think that's such a good question, because the way that I think of it is that these should be our clinic policies. It's not just my personal opinion or my personal policy. It's our whole clinic, and ideally our whole medical system treats these things the same way. That is, it's not that I mistrust my patient. It's that I want to give them the best care possible. And if these medications aren't working for them, they're not improving their pain, we do these risk assessments, they are at too high of risk, it's not the right option. So it's me providing excellent care for my patient. It's not necessarily a fight or a struggle that they want something and I won't give it. It's more, again, trust, communication, relationship, figuring out what's best for that patient.
So we might have a clinic policy for how we manage diabetes or refills on medications, and it takes some pressure off of you as a provider.
Right, certainly. Then we had mentioned also having providers different providers within the same clinic having similar policies so that when my patient has to see someone else when I'm out, there's no stigma, there's no differential treatment or anything like that. We all follow the same rules, so to speak.
Let's talk for just a moment about benefit, because we've talked some about the risk, and we could certainly talk a lot more about overdose. That's a huge problem, and what steps can be taken, and maybe you can comment on that at the end. But what are if we're doing this well, talk about benefits, and what do we know about long-term chronic pain management with opiates, maybe without opiates, but narcotics, but what happens? Can we really do this well?
We can. There are studies that show, especially at moderate doses, that these medications are safe long-term and that patients can return to function. I have a particular patient who he works in a chicken processing plant, and he is able to go to work every day because he's on these medications. And when he came to me, he was not. And we were contemplating, does he need to be disabled permanently? And that is such a shame. He's an active 60-something-year-old and is now back to work full-time.
Nice. That's and those types of things, I think, are just as important as us trying to limit people who are abusing.
Definitely.
And so what, you know, thinking about our listeners who are out there, what are the best pieces of advice that you can give to our listeners who are out there, perhaps with a loved one or themselves suffering from chronic pain and not having answers or feeling like they can't get them? What do you recommend?
I recommend definitely finding a physician that you have a good relationship with, whether that's your primary care physician or whether you need to seek someone else, but establishing that relationship and then being willing to be creative and try different things. Certainly, sometimes we need these medications, but if your clinician strongly recommends that you try some other medication or some physical therapy or something else, then definitely being willing to give it a good try, because they may, you know, be balancing these negative ramifications of these medications versus the benefits.
And what would be a tip? And we do have several doctors who listen to our show. What would be a tip for our physicians listening and for us to really take to heart?
I would say being consistent. So being consistent, having a clinic policy that includes treatment agreements, that includes urine screens. That way you can rely more on the trust of your patient and not have to worry so much about the legal ramifications.
Trust Excellent. And verify.
Right. Trust and verify. That's a great way of putting
well,
it.
You know, we're going to need to take a break, but we want to thank Dr. Kelly Bossenbruck, assistant professor in the UNC Department of Family Medicine, coming and talking with us about dealing with the controversies in chronic pain, not just the controversies. Thank you for sharing your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dr. Bossenbruck.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to take a few minutes to talk about your health questions and concerns.
And you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu or go to our iPhone or Android app and email or call directly from the application. And now, Christy, let's listen to our very first House Call about viruses. Ugh.
My 6-year-old daughter had a vomiting virus that made her feel pretty awful. After no vomiting in 48 hours, I let her go back to school, but the nurse called saying she was feeling tired and didn't want to do recess. No further vomiting, but do you think I exposed the other kids to her virus by sending her back too early? How long are you supposed to wait?
I said, Christy, not because of the question that was coming up, but because viruses, they're all around us, and we've seen so many of them in this last few months here in the winter and early spring.
it sounds like you did the right thing by waiting a good, 48 hours after no further vomiting or symptoms sounds pretty reasonable. But these things can hang around for up to a week, sometimes a little more, where a child can still feel yucky from having the virus, even though they're not continuing to throw up. Those symptoms can come 12 hours to 4 days after an exposure, and usually they're shedding the virus and contagious to people even before they start vomiting and having diarrhea.
Shedding virus? Yuck, Christy.
I know, but it's everywhere.
And so here's the dilemma. Here's the real dilemma here is that by the time you go back to school, you're usually not infecting anyone.
Right.
As a matter of fact, there's really good reasons for a lot of times that you may not actually have to come out of the school environment with proper hand washing and so forth. But the school has, there's all kinds of feelings here. There's your feelings, there's your child's feelings, there's the doctor's feelings, and there's
the parents of the other children.
That's right. And all of these things seem to conspire here in times to make this, I don't know, evidence-based, but lots of opinions.
Thank you for your question. I'm glad it sounds like she's better.
Let's listen to our very next house call from someone who enjoys having a drink before bedtime.
I am an 80-year-old woman, and I drink 2 scotch drinks per night. I always have done this, and I've never had a problem with it. My doctor says it is too much, especially considering my age and living alone. But I feel like it is fine. What do you think?
So this falls into the category for me of risky drinking. And technically, considering that you're a woman, it falls into heavy drinking. So drinking more than 7 drinks a week or more than 3 drinks on one occasion for a woman of any age is considered heavy drinking. For men, that's 14 drinks a week or more than 4 at once considered heavy drinking. So, that does... It sounds risky just considering that you're drinking that much per week and your age. And it sounds like your doctor's concerned. But I'd be interested in what your family thinks. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I had an aunt here, Christy, many years ago passed away, but she had her 2 shots of bourbon every night. Now, she lived to a very ripe age. She also had Alzheimer's at one point in time.
Oh.
And we talked about this actually with her or about, at various points in time, was this a problem or not? And I guess you could probably come down on different ways, and they're both probably valid. And I certainly understand this from our medical viewpoint. For an individual here, it's about your quality of life and what you perceive it in terms of the value to you of this or not. Certainly, most providers would say if you cut down to one, we would be happier.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it hasn't affected you yet, so I'm not so hesitant to say I'm the only one who has a right opinion here.
Sure.
I don't know.
I think as your provider, I'd want to know more about what medicines you're on and who lives at home. And it sounds like you're living alone, but who's checking on you and that sort of thing. But it's an important conversation. I think it sounds good that your doctor has actually expressed some concern and that you're willing to talk about it. So bring a family member and y'all should talk about it.
Yeah, and I like scotch better than bourbon, so. But it wouldn't make any difference if it were bourbon.
Okay.
Let's listen to our very next house call.
My son is 8 years old and has a problem with his weight. Our whole family is heavy, and I don't want him to have a problem. His doctor said his BMI is off the chart, and I'm worried about it. How do I break the cycle of our family's weight problems?
Wow. This is a tough, tough issue. Christy, when I was in Atlanta, I happened to be eating breakfast at Embassy Suites. No marketing for their product, but it's a good hotel. And at the breakfast line, and I saw probably an 8 to 10-year-old who probably had a BMI, a body mass index, of probably 35 at that age. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I saw the mother and the sister, and they also had body mass indexes that large. I know this is really tough.
I know. We really need to have a whole show on this. I saw a 4-year-old the other day that was 20 pounds overweight at 4 years old. Really, really tough stuff. And it's hard to, you as a mom sounds like, you get it, that this is finding a way to break a cycle that is partly related to genetics, but maybe also related to family culture. And
well, yeah, what I saw on the plate of this family at that breakfast were, 2 sausage biscuits each, big plates of scrambled eggs, a big bowl of cereal, a waffle, and some fruit. And this was per person. And so I knew that this was a real problem that was being perpetuated. This family wasn't working on it like you are.
I think it starts with a real family gathering of, and a lot of times we'll do family meetings with
a
doctor.
Great idea.
Get a nutritionist involved and get the buy-in of everybody who's involved in the purchasing of food and the preparation of food.
Well, that's a nice place to bookmark that conversation. Let's listen to our very last house call, which is really just a comment from a listener. We don't get too many just kind of comments, and this one probably speaks for itself.
I just had the best experience in the emergency room that I've ever had. I took my 10-year-old there because she slammed her finger in the car door and it was bulbous and blue and bleeding and we were concerned about it. So we put her finger in ice and raced over to UNC. They took our car for us and with a smile parked it for us so we didn't have to worry about it. They raced us into the emergency area. We signed her information. They brought her into another room. They separated her from adults so she didn't have to be threatened by having sick adults around her. And before we even had time to sit down and get comfortable in that children's waiting area, somebody came along to bring us to the doctor. Every doctor, every step of the way was so helpful. I was just incredulous. I just couldn't believe how attentive they were, how kind they were, how they kept it moving so she didn't have to wait, how they comforted her. I was really impressed by the whole experience.
Well, that's what emergency medicine is supposed to be, emergency care in a timely way, in a caring fashion. And I'm glad to hear that.
That's efficient and effective. And we love it when it happens at UNC. We would love it at any emergency room. Thank you so much for sharing that story with our listeners.
And thanks for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, important to your health. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Go to our blog online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our iPhone app.
Our iPhone or Android application. Google search Your Health Radio. Three separate words. And then you can find us and let us know what you think. And we'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Kelly Bossenbrock. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we can't wait to talk with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.